Game On 2FM.
With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Now, thanks to Emma Power for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Thursday, the 10th of June, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Roddy Forsyth on Celtic's new manager and how Scotland are shaping up for the Euros.
And Marshall has saved! It's a happy ending for Scotland for a change! A night for the players! A night for the fans! A night for all of Scotland!
We knew that coming into the game we could give a little something to this country and because we deserve it. You know, we've been through so many years. We know it, you know it, everyone knows it, and it's the monkey off the back now, and we're just going to move on from here.
In tennis, Conor Nyland will set us up for the final rounds at Roland Garros, where Djokovic is pumped for his semi-final with Nadal.
Yeah! Set their match, Djokovic.
Berrettini will be very disappointed, but look at this man.
Jeff Shepherd has our eye on America as Aaron Rodgers picks Hawaii over preseason. Kind of don't blame him. And Ina Reardon is in studio with the latest on the Irish athletes qualified for Tokyo.
Look at these times. Look at Ireland. They've actually run one of the quickest times here this evening, and they will take a place in tomorrow night's final.
Those heats got quicker and quicker from heat one to heat two, and then from heat two to heat three.
They were brutal, weren't they? And I'm just trying to work out the finalists, and I think Bar's efforts are definitely worth it because they've made that place into the final.
Now, if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Now, I mentioned in my intro that I am joined in studio by Ina Reardon of the Irish Times. Ina, I'm taking you in out of the sunshine, those lovely Wicklow mountains, to bring you in here to a dark studio to chat about sport.
Well, no better even to be in talking about sport, because I'm just coming through the suburbs there and there's a real hum around the city again. Well, certainly the suburbs, and it's, you can see kids playing at the park again. There's a real sense of just the city coming alive, and cycled through UCD and they're not quite there yet, but that kind of college atmosphere is coming on very quick. And you know, it's only the start of the summer, so I still think there's a lot of sport to look forward to this summer, especially outdoors.
Yeah, I was actually in the park myself last night and there was loads of games going on, all different age groups, men's, women's, children. The grass was cut. It was just lovely, and it genuinely felt normal actually last night for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, and all the things you miss, just that spontaneous being able to go out and play a game on the street or the roads or wherever. And we're still not quite there yet, and I know they're talking about a few pilot test events over the next few weeks, and the big question now is how quick they can get crowds back in. And it's not just a case of throwing the doors open and letting 5,000 people take their own seat. Like, there's still going to be a lot of restrictions in terms of how you take your seat or where exactly you sit, but I think there's a real appetite now just to get back and watch live sport, especially as the championship kicks off in a few weeks.
Yeah, that's for sure. The match I was at last night was actually a challenge game, and there were so many people at it, all desperate to get out and see people playing again, and as you said, just go out and meet people, you know, babies in buggies, people catching up, going for walks. It really was lovely. But I'm actually going to take it on a bit of a negative note now, even though we started with such positivity, Ian, but we have been discussing quite extensively on the show about what happened when Ireland were playing Hungary and how the players were booed for taking the knee. Well, the story took a bit of a darker turn today when the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban defended the booing of Irish players taking the knee, insisting the custom related to slavery and was alien to the Central European country. So look, it was just interesting to hear him say that, but I don't think that, from my point of view anyway, that is an excuse for what happened. Even in the moment watching it, if that is their belief, it still felt like it was wrong, that it was racism. It felt uncomfortable. I felt sorry for everybody involved, even the Hungarian players pointing to their respect badge, but obviously for the Irish players who had planned on doing this and felt it was important to them. And just the whole story as well that was around the Ireland team and the diversity in the team now and how welcome that's been. But to hear the Prime Minister come out and defend the booing is, it's quite remarkable, really.
Yeah, I just think I said to you there a few minutes ago, Marie, I when I watched that live, I was just kind of watching it in the background and I still couldn't believe it was happening for real. I kind of thought, not this day and age, and not given, there's been so much publicity about this, and then for people not to come out immediately, whether it was FIFA or UEFA, and to just to sort of say, look, this is not acceptable, number one, and secondly, maybe seek some sort of penalty for the Hungarian supporters, I don't know. But then when you have a Prime Minister coming out and backing it, look, we've still a long way to go, and I mentioned there as well, this, the Tokyo Olympics is coming up. This is a very sensitive issue around the Tokyo Olympics. Don't forget, sports protests more or less began on the Tokyo medal podiums, and there's a huge debate now about whether what's acceptable and what's not. And of course, you've got I think the rule is you've got the right to protest, but kind of within reason. And I think the danger is some people might take advantage of this in a negative way. And it's still a very sensitive one. But I think what we saw on Tuesday night was certainly a step back rather than a step forward.
Yeah, for sure. And we're going to see a lot of players taking the knee and teams taking the knee in the Euros, which are starting tomorrow. And just a little bit earlier, the Scottish players have decided as a collective that they are going to stand up to racism at Euro 2020 rather than taking the knee before matches. They had actually switched to standing for the start of their World Cup qualifying campaign in March after their head coach Steve Clarke claimed that the knee gesture had become a little bit diluted. So that is something that they have decided to do. They're going to stand up, and we're going to be chatting to Roddy Forsyth a little bit later about that, because he had that story earlier. And look, I think the Euros will be a lot of conversation about this and about the public and the fans' reaction to taking the knee. It's going to crop up quite a bit. Earlier today, actually, Brian Kerr was asked about it. He spoke to Andrew O'Connor.
I think it's vital in the current mix of population we have in Ireland now. We saw the reaction to the Irish players taking the knee at the international game in Budapest the other night in Hungary. And, you know, with everybody's view here in Ireland, was a disgraceful reaction. We've seen the reaction in England to the English team at their matches in Middlesbrough lately, and just the mind boggles at the attitude of some people. So I think it's vitally important that we have events like this that are about unifying people, about respect of different cultures, about respect of different backgrounds and colours and creeds. And we can't afford to neglect the potential for further racism in Ireland. We already have an issue around racism, not just in sport, but in life in general. We've had some very, very serious incidents in recent times that we're aware of, sadly. So it's very, very important that we don't just sit on our hands and hope everything will get better.
Brian Kerr speaking to RT Sports' Andrew O'Connor a little bit earlier, and speaking a lot of sense as well, that we shouldn't be sitting on our hands and expecting things to get better, because unfortunately it doesn't work like that, Ian.
No, and good to hear Brian there talking from the heart as ever. And he's right, like, Brian is kind of on the grassroots, and of course it's not just in soccer. I mean, GA or athletics, a lot of them, but there's been so much good work done. I mean, the Show Racism the Red Card and GA and a lot of these campaigns, I think, have been quite successful. And I think the new generation are much less tolerant of this than, dare I say, our generation. So that's why I'm saying, that's why I thought Tuesday night was just a step back. It wasn't even that it was acceptable or not. We know it's not acceptable, but just to see the age group of the crowd and some of the reaction of the supporters. But look, I'd like to think maybe it's a bit of an exception as well, and we're not going to see too much of that in the Euros for all the reasons you just explained, that I just don't think it's acceptable. But I mean, that should have been stamped out. That should have been, people should come out straight away and said it's not acceptable. And I don't know, maybe Hungary should have had some penalty about losing home games down the road, and then maybe the message might get through eventually.
Yeah, you'd think so, that they're should be taking stricter action, but when Prime Minister comes out with statements like that, it's hard to see that happening. And it's just interesting, I guess, as well, when you mentioned the next generation, the younger generation, and we saw Shadozie Ogbeni coming on and becoming the first African born player to play for Ireland, but you've probably seen it in athletics for quite a while now.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all the sports, I mean, even when I was competing back in my day, I mean, athletics was an absolutely multicultural sport, and any event, distance running, sprinting, whatever, and it was always there in Ireland. And if you look at some of the up and coming athletes now, whether it's Rashida Adeleke, for example, one of our top 200 metres. I mean, she's obviously born in Ireland. She represents Ireland. She's a current Irish record holder in the 200 metres. So that's absolutely acceptable in athletics. And I'd like to think that that sport has maybe not led the way, but certainly shown the way to some extent. And they've spoken out about it before, that it's still not perfect. And I remember listening to Nadia Power tell a story recently that you still get the odd one, but that's, you just have to ignore that because that's always going to be the exception. Whereas the rule, I think, in athletics now is it's a very highly tolerable sport.
Yeah, for sure. And it is actually great to see when, like Radhisha, who you mentioned there, just flying the flag for Ireland in the USA and doing unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, she's down at the University of Texas, which is not only one of the biggest schools in America, but one of the best in terms of academic standards. She's still only a freshman. Everyone's called a freshman over there, the first year. You're not a freshwoman, you're a freshman. And she's competing in the NCAA finals this weekend, actually, in the 200 metres. And yeah, she's had a phenomenal first season and she's kind of knocking on the door of Tokyo. She may not get a line, like over the line just yet, but just the fact that she's in the mix for that, and she for sure is the future of Irish sprinting. And it's difficult when you go over to college the first year and you get all that expectation and all the kind of the hype around it, but she's not only lived up to it, but I think surpassed us.
Yeah, for sure. I love following her on Instagram and seeing how well she's doing and looking forward now to seeing how she does at the weekend. I mentioned yesterday to Ruby in that I love this time of the year because you do start to see people qualifying for games and, you know, you get that insight into the minority sports that you might not usually hear from. But there are a lot of people going to be heading to Tokyo, and it looks like that Team Ireland this year is on track to be the largest team that we've ever had.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose we should say at the outset here, what was it, a couple of weeks ago I was in here and I think we were saying, Tokyo, will they happen? Is it 50-50? And I think, look, right now I'd say probably 99%
sure. A couple of weeks is a long time in a pandemic. We figured that one out.
For sure. Like, yeah, and it's been, look, I know there's still a lot of, not so much negative publicity, but there is a genuine fear on the ground in Tokyo. Like, can they handle this? But the more I've delved into it, and even speaking from a media point of view, like, there's talk already that we're going to be tracked by GPS. Mm-hmm. If we go out of bounds, we're going to be sent home. We have to have a 14-day activity plan. So we have to tell them where we're going to be 14 days advance. Like, this is unprecedented for any sporting events. So of course it's not going to be 100% safe, but they're genuinely going to every length to make these Olympics safe.
Are you happy enough that you're going to have to wear a GPS tracker and check in basically what you're doing for every single hour of the day?
Well, there's not much of a social life around the Olympics games anyway, believe me. So maybe it's a good thing that we can't be escaping at night, but it's I think it's acceptable. Yeah, I would. And I've said this from day one that, look, the Olympics, it's a once in a lifetime for so many athletes. Yeah, of course, there's going to be negative impacts in terms of being in the village and being able to just have supporters in the crowd, the family, all the things you'd associate with the Olympics. But every athlete I spoken to, hand on heart, has said, look, they accept that. They'd much rather have the Olympics happen than not. And if you look at the list of athletes, I think we've got 16 sports. I've counted well over 60 or 70 athletes so far, and they're not done yet. There's a few other sports still to go. I know we have men's rugby sevens have an outside chance. There's still a few qualifications to come in maybe track and field. Definitely there's a few more athletes coming there, but I think it's going to be well over the 70 or 80 mark, which will be one of the biggest teams of all time. But secondly, look at the medal hopes we have across all the sports, whether it's, I mean, the rowing. I think it's a given that the rowing are real medal hopes. You have obviously Rhys McLennan in gymnastics. You have our equestrian team are going to be really strong. Taekwondo, we've got a really good medal contender there in Jack Woolley. So I think once the games get going and we start to see the success coming home, then I'd like to think people will see that, look, it was a good idea for these games to go ahead. And again, it's a positive step. And if they hadn't gone ahead, then the negative downside of that, I think, would have been far greater than perhaps some of the risk that may be there with the games going ahead.
Yeah, it does feel like it was a couple of weeks ago when you were in, and I think we were a little bit worried. We'd heard from a journalist who was on the ground there who gave us a bit of a boost, really. But it does all seem to have calmed down a little bit now. Like, there isn't as much noise about the situation over there, about their lockdown or their lack of vaccinations or the volunteers dropping out. It seems to be nearly accepted that this is happening.
Because again, they've seen what's going on the ground. And I know, for example, just reading the latest out there, like, they've closed off lots of the roads around the main stadiums. Now, we're still not sure whether they're going to have local Japanese spectators. And even if they do, it's going to be a very small number. And that's mainly because they've sold so many tickets. But I think I read recently somewhere that not all the Japanese will even look for a refund. But it's going to be difficult. And look, there probably will be pockets of COVID. We've seen it in other sports where there's going to be one or two.
The Euros already, with Sweden and Scotland.
And that's the risk or the gamble certain athletes take. But the Olympics, I mean, people think that, I know there's a lot of hype about all the athletes being condensed in the village, and yeah, they are, but the Olympics are actually quite spread out. Like, it's not it's not as if everything is happening in downtown Tokyo. I mean, I know the golf is quite far away. The rowing is down by the coast. Obviously, the sailing, I think, is down by the coast. The equestrian is well outside of Tokyo. So it's not going to be this mass sort of assembly of sporting events that some people are painting it at. And plus, I know if you read the guidelines, once your event is done, you have to go home. So there'll be no hanging around. I think in the Olympic Village, they've banned the sale of alcohol because they don't want athletes getting a little bit too merry after their event. So there's all these kind of things going on. But I genuinely feel that once these games happen, or sorry, begin, that there'll be a real sense of this is the right thing to do. And look, people keep asking me, why are they happening? There's two reasons why they're happening. Number one, it's money. That the IOC, this is their biggest payday of the 4 years. There's huge TV rights. If they don't happen, there's huge losses. But I think secondly, there's a realisation as well for the athletes. I mean, it's almost 5 years now that someone has been trying to qualify. If you look at the women, if you look at the boxing team at the weekend, I thought that was the real, that to me kind of summed up just what a journey it's been, especially for the likes of Kelly Harrington. Mm-hmm. And people forget, Kelly hasn't made Olympics before. This is going to be her only chance. I remember speaking to her last summer, and she more or less admitted that if Tokyo didn't happen, she was probably going to retire. She accepted that. She comes out, not only does she qualify, she wins a gold medal. Now I think she's an absolute medal favourite for Tokyo. And that's the kind of once-in-a-lifetime story that I'm talking about. And then, of course, the brother and sister from Belfast, Aidan Walsh and his sister, Michaela Walsh. We're trying to work out how many Irish brothers and sisters have competed in the same sport in the same Olympics. And from what I can tell, there's only one brothers who can top that would be the Hoopers, Pat and Dick Hooper, who ran in the same event, the marathon, in the same Olympics in Moscow in 1980.
Oh, that would be an interesting article to actually read, just about the different families. I'm sure there are probably a lot more spread out across the world, but definitely a few come to mind. And just in terms of our athletes, so Tommy Barr is doing what Tommy Barr does, peaking at the right time.
Yeah, I mean, shout out for Thomas Barr, because it was Monday night in Turku, low-key enough event, but he went up there, hadn't got the qualifying time yet, and not that he was under pressure, because he's a pretty cool guy at the best of time, but no, he bangs it straight on, 48.3 or 48.4, and it's his fastest time since winning the bronze medal in Germany somewhere. He's coming bang on form. We think we have about six or seven automatic qualified athletes, including, that we heard at the outset there, the four by four mixed medley relay, which Thomas Barr is also going to be in. Kieran McGeehan's also qualified. She's running tonight in 1500 metres in the Diamond League in Italy. And then it's about at least 10 or 12 will qualify what we call as a quota. In other words, they'll get in their ranking system. The likes of Phil Healy, the likes of, certainly, I suspect, Sarah Lavin is probably in that mix. So it'll be probably the best part of 25, 30 athletes, including the marathon, obviously the race walks. People always ask me the question, what are the medal contenders, or can we win a medal in track and field, which is going to be always so difficult. Don't forget, the last person to actually win a medal on the track or field was Sonia O'Sullivan in 2000. Now we have Robert Heffernan, obviously, in London in retrospective bronze, but medals don't come along very often in track and field. But if you'd asked me going into Rio, would Thomas Barr finish fourth in the 400 metre hurdles, I would have said no chance. So if you're asking me now, we've got a medal and I say no chance, well, there's history there being proven wrong.
Yeah, that's for sure. It is great to see Tommy on form just so close to these games. And what about Kieran McGeehan? She is running tonight. She's already qualified, but we haven't seen very much of her for the last while.
No, good question. I think Kira, she said recently she's in the best shape of her life. And I think Kira initially, I would have thought, was possibly one of the athletes who it wasn't ideal that the Olympics were postponed, because she had a really good 2019, mm-hmm. which seems like a lifetime ago now. She made the final of the World Championships, ran the fastest of her life, just over 4 minutes. She was really set up for a big 2020. As it turned out, she came out and had a big start to the year. Remember, she broke the Irish 800 metre record. Yeah. She broke Sonia's.
Came out of that first lockdown, wasn't it?
Yeah, she broke Sonia's 2000 metre record, and she ran another fast time, I think, in the miles. So then she kind of, her form dipped a little bit, and then indoors we didn't see the best of her at all. So I don't know. I think there's no doubt that she hasn't shown any form yet this year, but tonight would be a big test. And then there's three or four races where I know she's lined up to try and run fast times. But Kira being Kira, you know she's going to give it her best over there. And I genuinely think she's probably one of her few chances of a finalist on the track. Thomas Barr being another one. Maybe Michelle Finn in the steeplechase. Because it's going to be so competitive. Because these Olympics, because everyone has... everyone has put so much effort into qualifying now. I suspect it's probably going to be one of the most, I don't know if you saw during the week, we saw the women's 10,000 metre record being broken twice within 48 hours, which is some example of just how much athletics has moved on. We won't go into the exact details for that, but I don't think I've seen...
Did see Paul Dennehy tweeting that the Adidas are bringing out their brand of shoes, I think, this week. So it'll be interesting to see how they're compared to the Nike Vaporflies.
Yeah, I just wish I had those spikes back in my day, because I think my PBs would be a little bit quicker.
I know, that's the thing, I can only imagine. Okay, Ian, we're going to take a very... Oh, the O'Donovan brothers, another example of siblings at the Olympics. A text in there. We're going to
exactly,
take
good break. Point. In the same boat as well, yeah.
In the same boat, exactly. We're going to take a very quick break.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are going to turn our attention to football. Earlier today, it was confirmed that Ange Postecoglou has been named as Celtic's new manager. A bit of a left field choice, but has definitely left people curious. Journalist Roddy Forsyth joins us now. Roddy, how are you and how are you feeling about Celtic's new manager?
Well, first of all, on a personal basis, I'm just fine. I hope you are too. I was impressed by the way you pronounced that. It's a fair old mouthful, Ange Postecoglou. Greek-born Australian, he took the Celtic support by surprise, and they weren't the only ones to be surprised by his appointment. Nobody had really a clue that he was being pursued. 106 days after Neil Lennon quit, and of course after the long courtship of Eddie Howe came to nothing, Celtic have at last confirmed that Lennon's successor will be Mr. Postecoglou. He was in charge of Australia when they qualified for the World Cup finals in 2014 and 2018, although he quit in 2017 to join Yokohama F. Marinos. Not the sort of feeder club Celtic are used to. And he'll have to undergo COVID-19 quarantine rules to allow him into the country before he can take charge of the squad. So he won't be there when the squad first assemble after their holidays. He also holds an Australian pro coaching licence, which isn't recognised by UEFA. So Celtic have asked UEFA to give him a short-term certificate of competency to allow him to get to work while he gets his UEFA badges. Now, Celtic have been letting it known behind the scenes that they've actually kept an eye on this chap for years. So if that's true, you'd think they might have mentioned that if he ever was to come, he would need those badges. And it seems to have taken everybody by surprise. Still, there is a precedent for it. Celtic once had Wim Jansen as their manager. He came from Hiroshima Sanfrecce. He was actually at one point in charge of such a poor run of form that the local media dubbed him the second worst thing to hit Hiroshima. But he came to Glasgow and stopped Rangers winning 10 in a row. And above all, he brought Henrik Larsson to Parkhead, for which he would be forgiven any sin. So if Postecoglou can do anything like that, if he can bring a new Larsson, then the Celtic fans will bow at his feet. But that's a large supposition.
That really is. So how are the Celtic fans reacting to this news? I think they thought they were going to get Eddie Howe, and now they have Postecoglou.
Well, Eddie Howe, of course, that was going on for months. In fact, there were a couple of websites, football websites, that had him down as the next manager of Celtic as long ago as last September. So he kept on being touted so frequently that I was expecting that whenever I drove up to Celtic Park, he'd be hanging around outside waiting to get in. But he never turned up. Seemingly there was a problem with his coaching staff. Anyway, it's never been properly explained. He didn't turn up. And so on to this chap. One area of speculation had concerned Steve Clarke, the Scotland manager, and Roberto Martinez, the manager of Belgium. Steve Clarke, it was thought, might be persuaded to come to Celtic after taking Scotland through whatever progress they have in the Euros. Likewise, Roberto Martinez is a former Motherwell player who's assistant with Belgium, who have for a long time been number one in the world in the FIFA rankings. His assistant is Sean Maloney, who was a Celtic striker and product of the Celtic Academy. So there was the feeling that that's where Celtic might turn. And certainly most Celtic fans, at least those on social media, have been saying, Ange Postecoglou, who?
Well, I think that's probably a lot of people who needed to look up a little bit about him, because I guess the question I have really is, there have been a lot of people that have come out and supported him. Gordon Strachan, Pep Guardiola, Brendan Rodgers, they've all said nice things about him in the past and about his ability and what kind of a manager he is and how much potential he has. But why has it taken him till now to get a job in Europe?
You might ask, why has it taken Celtic this long to recognise this prodigy? And that's the question that Celtic fans are asking. There's no obvious answer to it. That's the interesting part. Because also, that when you're bringing somebody in who's a European boss and you bring him from Europe, you're expecting at that stage of the game that this is a fellow who will be well quoted in terms of recruitment, that he would know who he wants, that he's had, you know, let's say he'd come from a Greek team who were competing, say, in the Champions League or the Champions League qualifiers, you'd be expecting him to have some knowledge of the kind of players whom he would want to take to any club, and that would include Celtic. We haven't got any sense that that's the case here. So he's in for quite an interrogation whenever he turns up, and we do him by Zoom or whatever method we're going to actually be able to speak to him. He comes across, from what we know of him in Australia, he's a no-nonsense boss. He was a player at South Melbourne and succeeded Frank Arock as manager there. It was his first management post. Now, I met Frank Arock years ago. To give you some idea of the climate of the management of this club, Frank Arock was known as Mad Dog and was proud of that nickname. And so it's no surprise you might find that Ange Postecoglou, his motto is my way or the highway. So I think we're going to have some authentic Australian grit, even if it's flavoured perhaps by a little Greek background.
All right, well, that will be interesting to see how it works out, just given how vocal as well the Celtic fans can be. But I just wonder as well, just with the modern game and how much focus there is on the way that teams play now, do we know anything about his football philosophy, what way he likes to set up his teams?
Well, we gather that he likes a high-energy press, which wouldn't be unlike Brendan Rodgers' spell at Celtic Park, where that was what he insisted that the team do. There were some critics of that, some people feeling that that's why it cost them in Europe. They weren't able to break the later stages of Europe as he would have liked. That it was something you could do in Scotland against lesser opposition, but it would wear players out in the longer term. So be that whichever side of the argument you're on in that case, then it will probably be directed also at Mr. Postecoglou, because, as I say, he likes to have this high energy pressing game as we understand it, an athletic game, something that's perhaps more characteristic of the Australian football atmosphere than it would be in Japan. But I understand that he tried a version of that there too, and they did. Yokohama F. Marinos did win the J-League, so he can at least say that he has been in charge of the domestic champions in the country where Celtic are bringing him from.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you predict it will be a success, this new partnership?
I have my doubts. I'll say it in the Scottish dialect. I have my doubts, and I think it's risky. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
If it works, that's the whole joy of sport, isn't it? In football, if it works, suddenly the Celtic board are geniuses. But they were in a difficult position. I mean, I have some significant sympathy for them, I must say. I thought they did the right thing with Neil Lennon. The Celtic support was going potty about getting rid of him because the 10 in a row, the ambition of succeeding in 10 successive titles was evaporating. But don't forget, he won the Scottish Cup, the deferred 2020 final in December, and took Celtic, therefore, to a fourth consecutive treble. That's an unmatched feat that was begun by Brendan Rodgers and finished by Neil Lennon, who also won the treble as a player and a manager previously with Celtic. Nobody else can say that. So I thought Celtic did the right thing by letting him have as much time as he could possibly have expected to try and revive the 10 in a row. But that's made it perhaps a little more difficult for them to get the kind of coach that they would have wanted when they wanted it.
You mentioned Neil Lennon there. He has been in the headlines today. He's been quite critical of the Celtic fans, saying that they're a new breed of supporters that he had nothing in common with and belie the values of the club. Was he getting a bit of stick for coming out against them?
He's got stick for having said what he said, but he was reacting to the fact that during the COVID lockdown in Glasgow, when the city was a tier 3 lockdown category, that there were Celtic fans turning up at the stadium to throw bottles at the bus and chuck railings at the police because they weren't getting 10 in a row. And that's a pretty privileged position to have 9 in a row. Celtic have done it before under Jock Stein. Of course, Rangers did it under Walter Smith. I have a friend who's a physicist who says that 10 in a row is the Scottish football equivalent of the speed of light. You can't beat it, you can't break it, you can't go faster. And Celtic fans just have to understand that. He's a Celtic fan, incidentally. And Neil Lennon felt that what he had achieved with the club had simply been ignored because of this fetishistic compulsion to achieve 10 in a row and therefore have bragging rights over Rangers for the foreseeable future. And I'll make a prediction here to you. You've asked me about Postecoglou, but I would say there's a pretty good chance that in what remains of Neil Lennon's managerial career, he'll be back at Celtic for a third time once the dust settles and people see what he did for the club as a player, as a manager in two separate spells. It's a real body of work and achievement, and it just hit a time when we were in artificial circumstances with COVID-19 and the lockdown and no crowds, and also Celtic trying to get something that had simply never been accomplished either by them or Rangers previously.
OK, well, while we're on predictions, we might as well move on to the Euros because... I was looking with a little bit of envy, I have to say, at the groups and seeing Scotland there, games against Czech Republic, Croatia and England. So much to look forward to if you're a Scottish football fan, to have your team in the Euros and to be playing some of those games at home as well, and also to be heading to Wembley to take on England. How do you think they're going to fare?
Well, it's an interesting one because I mentioned Steve Clarke a little earlier. Now, Steve Clarke did an extremely good job at Kilmarnock while he was there. That was the job he had before he got the Scotland job. And it was the job that got him the Scotland job. He was the people's choice because of what he had done at Kilmarnock, where in the calendar year 2018, they were the team with the most points. Celtic, although Celtic had played two games fewer, were behind them, as were Rangers. He had taken a team that was bottom of the Scottish Premiership when he got there in October 2017. And by the time he left in 2019, he had twice won the Manager of the Year award from PFA Scotland and also the Scottish Football Writers. And he'd got Kilmarnock to their highest placing in 38 years in the league and got them into Europe. Excuse me. So Scotland went for him as the obvious candidate. In the first games of the qualifying group, Scotland were in a very tough Euro qualifying group with Russia and Belgium, two teams you'd want to avoid if you could. And they were duly beaten home and away by both of them in the opening games of that section, with Scotland conceding 13 goals and scoring only one. Now look at their last 16 games. Scotland have only lost two games out of that. And that's the turnaround that's been affected by Steve Clarke. And if you happen to see the friendly that the Scots played against the Dutch and Portugal last week, Scotland were leading twice and it took two goals from Memphis Depay, very good goals indeed, to equalise and give the Dutch the benefit of a draw. Now I'm going to come on to a tender point here. Luxembourg, don't want to mention that name too loudly around Dublin, but Scotland beat them. Now, as you know, that would have been nothing remarkable in previous years, but most of us can think of a team who would really like to have beaten Luxembourg not too long ago instead of losing to them. So Scotland will take that and the Dutch game as good omens for what's to come. I believe they will qualify from the group. I would love to see them beat England at Wembley. Which Scot wouldn't do that? I think that might be beyond them, but I would believe that they can beat the Czech Republic in the opening game at Hampden Park at 2 o'clock next Monday.
Oh, it's so much to look forward to. And just in terms of the team as well, like just looking at the make of it, there's a lot of players playing with the top clubs in Scotland and quite a lot of players as well playing with some of the top teams in the Premier League, like a lot of familiar names, like Robertson at Liverpool for one.
Andy Robertson, who's the captain of Scotland, has a Champions League medal to his credit, and so does Billy Gilmour of Chelsea. So we didn't have that for a long time, then suddenly two at once, like buses. And also, Steve Clarke has introduced young players, Billy Gilmour being one. He's a teenager, as is Nathan Patterson of Rangers, who's come in, 19, got his debut, David Turnbull of Celtic. And also, the first thing that Steve Clarke did was stop Scotland leaking goals. So that in the autumn, there were two games that they played, one against Slovakia and the other, I think, off the top of my head, against the Czech Republic, but I may be wrong, where they only had one chance in one game and two chances in the other game, but they took them. And thus began to edge their way out of the problems that they'd had previously. Now he's begun to get goals from different departments. Jack Henry of Celtic, Kevin Nisbet of Hibs, both making their first starts recently and getting their first goals. Shea Adams of Southampton, 3 goals in 4 games. So there's beginning to be the feeling that Scotland will not be a prolific scoring team, but they now can begin to pick teams off as they did with the Dutch, as they did in Luxembourg.
Okay, well, you definitely have lots to look forward to. And Roddy, just who do you think is going to win the Euros before we finish up?
I've long had Portugal is most people's tip, I think, France, but I'll stick with Belgium. I think that the job that Martinez and Sean Maloney has done there is very impressive. They're the most consistent side, so I'm going to stick with Belgium.
Okay, well, we've got four predictions from you there, Roddy, in the last 15 minutes, so thanks for that. We're putting you to work. We will talk to you again very, very soon. And Ian, just before we move on from the Euros, who are your team for the competition?
Yeah, I could just listen to the talk even about the Scottish group there. Yeah, it's going to be such an exciting tournament. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but the hype has been quite low for obviously obvious reasons. The fact that the Republic of Ireland aren't there, maybe the spread of venues as mm-hmm. well. Maybe that's going to be different for everybody. I've always had a soft spot for Italy, but apparently Italy are very, very poor at the moment. I don't think they.
There are a lot of people's dark horses, and I think if they can, they probably will get out of the group. They seem to have a good run then.
Yeah, well, we'll see. But I think the main thing for me is just watching live football again and being you know, whatever number of crowds are in the stadium. And it's one of those games where you don't even have to have a favourite, or you just watch down and get drawn into the sort of romance of it all. But fair play to Scotland, though. If Scotland do beat England in Wembley next week, that'll be a result for the ages.
Yeah, they'll have a lot of fans. Okay, we're going to take a very quick break, and then it's tennis.
FM. Game on 2FM. With Green Farm. Green Farm's new cooked chicken breast fillets are 100% natural and packed with protein. Available in selected stores nationwide. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are turning our attention to tennis. There is a huge amount of sport on, but the French Open is at the semi-final stage with Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova of Russia getting through to her very first Grand Slam final. That match happened a little bit earlier and the second semi-final is taking place right now. Conor Nyland, former tennis player, joins us to talk us through all of the action. Conor, let's start with the women's semi-finals. It's quite an interesting situation because it's the first time since 1978 and only the second time in the Open era that a Grand Slam women's singles tournament has had four semi-final debutants.
Hey Marie, yeah, that's right. It's 1978, so it's been a while, and it's interesting that the top women, I suppose, obviously Osaka, having to withdraw at the start of the tournament. Serena Williams is approaching 40 in October. You've got Kvitova, probably the wrong side of, in terms of her career as well. So you're starting to see some younger players. But if Pavlyuchenkova is 29, she's been sort of top 10 in the world, top 50 in the world for about 10 years, but has never pushed on to this level. So you're going to, we're going to see a lot of nerves, I think. Today, we've got Sakkari and Krejcikova in a bit of a battle. I think it's 3-2 in the third. And then in the final, I think Sakkari might get the better of that one. That's on right now against Pavlyuchenkova. So it's going to be a big day for one of those on Saturday.
Is this the changing of the guard now? I know that you mentioned Pavlyuchenkova is 29 and she has been around for quite a while, but quite a dominant junior player, but never really reached this level of a Grand Slam semi-final. But is this a new generation now that is coming through?
I just think the players have a lot more belief now. There's just so much depth, and I think you've had so many different players winning Grand Slams over the last 5 or 6 years. And obviously on the women's side, it's best of three sets. So if they go out and put in a good sort of 45 minutes to an hour, all of a sudden they can be a set and a break up against a favourite. Whereas on the men's side, you've seen over the last week and a half, you've got players coming out and playing a great first set or second set, but it's a set all. They've still got to go and win two more sets, and the top guys just reel them in over that best of five set format. But with the women's over the best of three set, it is easier to make an upset. So I think that makes a huge difference.
Does it add to the pressure, do you think, that one of the three women now that are left, that they're going to be going into a final when there's the two of them there, and it's not going to be against an established name, someone that's been there, done that, that it is two final rookies, really, players going in there trying to win it? Which situation would you prefer to be in? Would you like to be up against, the Serena or somebody that you know feels exactly like you do at that moment?
They've been all monitoring the draw and watching it open up in front of them for the last 4 or 5 days. You can believe that. They're going to definitely prefer that they've got a player in front of them who hasn't been there either. But it does, as you say, add that little bit of extra pressure. The match today, Sakkari and Krejcikova has been interesting. It's been a lot of swings and momentum. You can see that they're just trying to play the occasion as much as the opponent. So yeah, it does bring a different type of a pressure, but they are all they're all seeing their opportunity here. This is going to be a once in a lifetime potentially for these players to win a slam.
Yeah, and you mentioned occasion there, and it is quite a different occasion, as we saw last night with Djokovic and the curfew and having to stop to let the people go home. It's all so strange, really, you know, just the whole atmosphere and the setup and trying to deal with a very different occasion.
Yeah, it was a very strange one last night. So obviously the curfew had been till 9 p.m. in Paris up until a couple of days ago, and then it was pushed out to 11 p.m. and there's been a few more people allowed in the stadium. And just when it was getting really juicy between Djokovic and Berrettini, 2-1, the players have to leave the court and have to clear the stadium. I guess rules are rules, but then you also have the players, the officials, the ball kids, you know, all the sort of cameramen, they're all still there. So there's either a curfew or there isn't. You know, you'd like to have seen the people be able to stay and watch it till the end for the sake of the 45 minutes. But look, that's the world we're in at the moment, I suppose. But yeah, it's not a full stadium. It's obviously been the first Roland Garros where there's been night matches. There's been some pros and cons to it. Obviously, the fact with the curfew, these night matches have been played in front of absolutely nobody. And what's great about the Aussie Open and the US Open at the night matches is there's a really great atmosphere. People have been around all day. They might have had a drink or two. It's a little bit rowdier. But with the French Open this year, we've had the night matches being introduced. But then it's sort of been a bit of a damp squib because there's literally nobody there. So I'd like to see that sort of come back next year and see if we can have some crowds and create a bit more atmosphere.
I was watching Djokovic last night and saw his reaction when he did win. And look, I guess we've all seen him do and say very strange things quite a lot over the last while. But he did get really animated. We played the clip at the very start of the programme. I might just actually play it again now.
Set the match. Djokovic.
Berrettini will be very disappointed. But look at this man.
So, Conor, what was that about?
The first code violation after a match I would have ever seen. It was from his core, wasn't it? I mean, I think the fact that there was nobody in the stands, I think it echoed around the stadium that little bit more, but I think the fact that he could really make a statement without any fans, he knew it would echo around the stadium. It was a bit of a statement to Nadal, I think. He was very flat in the final in October when he lost to Nadal. Nadal rolled over him. So I think he's just putting out a marker that I'm going to really compete here tomorrow in the semi-finals against Nadal, because he's going to have to bring his very best tennis against the greatest ever at Roland Garros. And I think he's going to really try and up it emotionally. I think he's probably a little bit disappointed with how that final went last year, just in terms of his emotional, activity. And I think that was part of that. But it was some prolonged display of emotion after it.
Yeah, I'll just jump in there, Conor, and say it sounded to me like somebody doing a successful weightlifting world record or something. But going back to the women's semi-finals there, because something I've noticed across all global sports now is you mentioned new generation, and whether it's athletics, obviously, and cycling, there's the younger guys now. We saw the Tour de France last year. Teddy Pogacar won the Tour de France of 2021. This new generation, not only are they young enough, are they good enough, but they don't seem to have a huge amount of respect for the older generation. I don't know, is that something that's maybe happening a bit more in tennis now as well? I mean, obviously Djokovic still around there, Nadal, but is that sense now these guys or girls aren't completely as unbeatable as they might have been in their prime?
Yeah, certainly. As I say, you're seeing that on the women's side because they've had people break through in front of them, and we haven't had that on the men's side yet. But the other semi-final tomorrow, Tsitsipas, Zverev is sort of the new generation, and probably they're probably the pick of that crop. So that will be really interesting to see that. I think Tsitsipas is ready to win a slam. Obviously, Zverev was 2 sets to love up in the final at the US Open last year against Thiem after Djokovic had been disqualified. But yeah, they are definitely starting to make big advances. But at the same time, when I look at it, Nadal and Djokovic, especially Nadal at Roland Garros, still look, just a shade or two above in level. And as I said, in terms of over a 5-set match, if you've got that advantage in terms of level, you can't be streaky for a set and go ahead and put a lot of pressure on the guy. They can read it back in. So on the men's side, it's so much tougher to sort of make their stamp. But it was interesting with Federer. Obviously, he's He's a couple of years older. He's 39 and 40 in August. But he went out and played Roland Garros, won his first three matches, and then pulled out and said that he didn't feel like he had a chance to win the tournament. So he wanted to protect his body and be ready for the grass court season, because he feels like that's his only really legitimate chance is at Wimbledon. So he's at Halle this week preparing for a grass court event. And I was really surprised that Federer did that. And I thought it was a little bit disrespectful of the tournament. I think the fact that he's had such a great track record in terms of the last 20 years of kind of doing the right thing so often, that we kind of gave him the benefit of the doubt. But I found it very strange. And also the fact that he didn't just say, look, I've got a bad back, I can't go out and play tomorrow. He didn't say he was injured and he is playing this week. He just simply said, look, I don't think I can win the tournament, so I'm off to get ready on the grass.
Yeah, it's certainly a first one. I can't remember that happening before.
No,
I
think
is there penalties for that?
Well, this is the thing. I think it's so unprecedented. I don't think he didn't get a penalty. No, he didn't get a fine and he didn't get a lot of criticism. Again, I think because of, his sort of body of work for being generally sort of a good guy. But I kind of strange, because if he had just said, look, I played three matches, I'm 39, I'm out here fighting and my back is stiff, I think everybody would have just said, yeah, of course. But he didn't say that. He didn't say he's injured. He just said, I don't think I can make a dent here, so I'm going to prepare for the grass, which is, I thought it was amazing, really.
It's quite interesting as well, just given the amount of attention that was on Naomi Osaka when she decided to withdraw for her mental health reasons, that there was so much conversation. I know it is different, but still at the same time, that Roger Federer story is quite interesting as well and probably does deserve a little bit more focus and analysis.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think it was 99% Osaka on the first week, and then everybody sort of said, okay, Roger, whatever you say, basically. So I think it was any other player that would have probably been a few questions asked. And I think if we see how he gets on in Halle this week, he's going to be gearing up for trying to make a dent in Wimbledon. Again, if he kind of starts to win a few more matches, will he do it again in Halle? Say, look, I won my... Will he pull out in the semi-final to the final in Halle? Trying to save himself at Wimbledon. So it's just a precedent that I think is a little bit worrying, that you're saying, well, look, I'm going to pick and choose here, and I might pull out if I don't think I can win the whole thing.
Yeah, well, you're not treating these competitions and tournaments with the respect that they deserve. Okay, just before we let you go, Conor, give us some predictions. Who's going to be victorious in the final? We might as well just skip straight through to save you doing the semi-finals, because that will your prediction from the final will.
Well, I think Sakari will. I think Sakari will win the women's. I just think she's been kind of building to it. I would have put her as an outsider even last year. She's just so her body language, her athleticism. She just brings so much to the table. I think she's just going to kind of really go for it on Saturday. I think she's going to be able to handle the occasion. So I'm going to go with her on the women's side. Nadal's won it 13 times, and I think he's going to win it a 14th time. But I think Tsitsipas is looking really, really interesting as a guy who I think could be a world number one over the next couple of years. So I'd love to see him in a final and watch those two guys face off.
Yeah, does make for exciting tennis. All right, Conor Nyland, thanks so much for joining us. 2FM.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range, available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It's time to cast our eye stateside with Jeff Shepherd. Shep, we haven't spoken to you in a couple of weeks. How is everything going?
Everything is going great over here, Marie, and an interesting time to be catching me today. We got a little breaking news going on out in the world of college football. It sounds like the playoff is going to be getting expanded from 4 teams to 12 teams starting this year, or maybe next year. The timing of it hasn't been completely announced, but this is huge. I mean, for the longest time, people have been trying to, get more teams involved and kind of have more of a tournament flair to the college postseason. And after some negotiations and debates continued, it seems like we finally are going to get an expansion to have a 12-team playoff.
Wow, it sounds like it'll be very, very glamorous, exciting and very professional as well, which leads us on to our next story quite well, Shep, because there was a meeting in Washington yesterday to discuss how to compensate college athletes for their name, image and likeness. So some states have already passed laws already that is going to allow for this to begin. But there are still a lot of questions to be answered. And as time goes on, these college athletes are becoming big stars and are professional in everything but name.
No, exactly right. Yeah, I mean, we talked about this maybe a month or so ago when this issue was kind of starting to heat up, and they had some, you know, meetings with some senators yesterday and the president of the NCAA. And what this boils down to is, you know, if a school goes ahead and uses one of their star athletes to put on a billboard or put on a ticket or make a shirt with them, you know, they've wanted to, the players have not ever had a chance to kind of get compensated for that before. And so there was a lawsuit a couple of years ago from a basketball player at UCLA. He was put into a game and he was like, they're using my likeness for a game and I'm not getting any money out of this. He's like, how is that fair? You know? And so it really kind of snowballed from that, maybe, you know, 7-8 years ago. And so several states are now passing laws that say, look, if you can go make money because you're a football player or a track athlete and you have an endorsement deal or a tennis player, you can go ahead and do it, and you're not going to lose your amateur status. And I think that's been the big discussion, is how do you go about saying you are an amateur, yet you're still going to be getting some money for it? And another big issue yesterday, Marie, that they talked about was, you know, you have these big schools, your Alabama's, your Ohio State's, your Michigan's, you know, schools like that. And then you have a lot of smaller schools, you know, that just, quite frankly, don't have the budgets like the big schools do. So how do you go about, you know, trying to level a playing field to where a kid can make some money at a much smaller school than someplace like that, and how much can be made? And so, again, there's just a lot that has to be worked out, because the laws basically were passed that said, hey, you can now earn money like this, but they never really said how you can go about doing it and how much you're going to get paid and what does that do to your scholarship. So, again, there's a lot of work that still has to be done.
Hi, Jeff. Can I jump in with one question here? Is part of the issue, sure, as well, that for years, like, I know my dad, who went to college in America in the 1960s, this was a subject back then. But since then, obviously, there's a lot more money into the sport and a lot of the payments are under the table. And there's all these endorsements, like players are getting new cars or new houses or new whatever, sure, it is. I'm assuming a big part of this bill or whatever it is to cut out that under the table type payments. Will that always be there no matter what level of legality comes in with this?
Yes, that's a great question. And yes, because a lot of that is involved with getting the kid to go to your school in the first place, you know, is, oh, well, this school's offering this. And you're right, it's completely under the table. It's here's the thing. It's quote unquote illegal, but there's not really like a law enforcement agency out there that can do anything about it. You know, a school would have to, you know, banish a booster if they get caught paying a kid some money, or, oh, this guy owns a car dealership, we're going to give this kid a job, and we're going to put job in quotes, but we're going to let him drive, you know, a new Camaro around campus the whole time, you know. So there's been all these different ways to get around, you know, the non-payments to players. I think it's still going to exist, but I think that's hopefully one of the benefits of this system, is players won't necessarily have to go out looking for that. But again, at the end of the day, if somebody's going to give you some money to go to a school, I mean, who's going to turn it down? And so that's, you know, that's probably always going to be there.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting and will be definitely worth following as well. Just before we finish up very quickly, Shep, Aaron Rodgers, what is he doing? Where is he? Is he going to go back playing at all?
So he was in Hawaii like 2 weeks ago. You know, he's got his new fiance, Cheyenne Woodley, you know, the actress. They were out, you know, climbing some cliffs out in Hawaii. And then, you know, his teammates in Green Bay are getting ready to go to minicamp this week. And he just doesn't even remotely seem interested in that. And so right now, he's technically, you know, a member of the Green Bay Packers. We have several months to go before the season starts and before he really has to make any types of decision. But right now, Jordan Love, the backup quarterback for the Green Bay Packers, is working with all the number ones and the starters and getting a lot of valuable reps right now. And we'll wait and see what Aaron Rodgers decides what he wants to do.
Yeah, it's a saga that is running and running. Jeff Shepherd, thanks so much for joining us. Ina Reardon, thanks as well for being in studio. We'll be back tomorrow. Paul Corry is going to join us. We'll be looking at the start of the Euros, the return of the League of Ireland after their break, and also the Republic of Ireland's game against Iceland. We'll be talking Gaelic football with Keith Higgins and hurling with Shane McGrath. Tara Stewart is up next.
Live across the nation, this is RTE 2FM.